Welcome back to There Is a Season, the Pete Seeger podcast. In this episode today, we begin examining Pete Seeger's albums and records after the period of the Blacklist. We will get into several of his famed live recorded performances from the early 1960s, both on Folkways and Columbia Records, and we will discuss Pete's efforts to bring folk music to people through television, particularly the controversy over censorship surrounding the Hootenanny television show. Pete Seeger's legal battles were behind him by the spring of 1962. While we should of course be careful not to make a patriarch out of Seeger, a status often relegated to him that he always despised, I think it is worthy to mention that his defiance of the powers that be during the Blacklist was quite impressive. He had taken on the House Un-American Activities Committee and, in many respects, had won. Now, while American society has arguably never fully gotten past the stereotypes and baseless assumptions of that period, Seeger had stood for something that needed standing up for. He had faced a bunch of men who very likely had no clue what the objectives and purpose were of the cultural work Seeger was trying to carry out. If they hadn't been so caught up in themselves or their ideologies, who knows? Maybe they would have found that they actually had more in common with Pete than they realized. Well, who really knows? At the end of the day, Pete Seeger did what he thought was right and made many sacrifices in the process. While many fans, celebrities, and other public personalities who have recognized Seeger over the years have done so because of his stance on civil rights or his anti-war singing and activism, what people tend to ignore about Pete is his having been targeted during the Blacklist and his contribution in fighting that in the ways that he did. Given that we live today in a world that has a barrage of information flowing everywhere constantly, we must protect against cultural or historical revisionism. If we are to appreciate Pete Seeger at all, we must observe and interpret his work not selectively, but in totality. It is only through this sort of method that we can fully appreciate the message and knowledge that this man was attempting to impart to all of us. Regarding Pete Seeger, what the Blacklist also reminds us of is that style is created by limitations. Despite the fact that Pete had been remarkably limited in his ability to perform like he had with the Weavers, he'd actually found some newfound freedom to pursue different musical directions. He had pioneered the college circuit and sang for children everywhere he could, the effects of which would become monumental. While we discussed much of this in the last episode, one additional notable performance worth going into a bit from this period was Seeger's Bowdoin College concert in 1960. Released for the first time in 2012 by Smithsonian Folkways Recordings, the complete Bowdoin College concert of 1960 was actually recorded by five or six students from the campus radio station there, who probably never anticipated a release like the one that happened over 50 years after the performance happened. This was also a unique event for Bowdoin because in 1960, the school's population was still all male, and it was only at fraternity parties and special events like this one when dates could be invited. Also interestingly, the event was a fundraising opportunity for the Campus Chest, which was a charitable organization funding local causes, tickets being $1.25 to see Seeger from 1 to 3 p.m. on a Sunday afternoon that March. According to Smithsonian Folkways archivist Jeff Place, who during the album's remastering reconnected with some of the students who recorded the show, there were discussions that revolved around reducing the concert to a single album's length. However, the decision was made to release it in full as a double album. As Place explains, by including the whole show without cutting any dialogue or scraping of Pete's fingers on the banjo strings, the experience is much more immersive for the listener than it otherwise would have been. For those who want to listen, it is seemingly available anywhere you digitally find music, the whole thing being 111 minutes long. In between songs, we hear Seeger talking to his audience, telling stories about people he'd met in England and in the US who taught him folk songs, giving the meaning of the songs a little more authenticity by trying to be a link in a chain for the students there. While the entire record is too long to deconstruct here, there are several tunes worth acknowledging. Seeger begins the concert mostly with traditional ballads from the American, Scottish, and Irish traditions, such as with Penny's Farm, Deep Blue Sea, and Hielan' Laddie. He then showcases his Appalachian-influenced banjo playing and masterful frailing technique with a medley of Cripple Creek, Old Joe Clark, and Old Dan Tucker. Seeger then mixes things up a bit with his own banjo arrangement of Summertime, of course composed by George and Ira Gershwin and DeBose Hayward in 1935 for the opera Porgy and Bess. As we know, Pete was always a fan of pop and jazz tunes of the 1920s and 30s, and his stylizing of these songs for the banjo truly is an incredibly unique act, as it is admittedly hard to think of any other five-string banjo players doing Gershwin. As far as Pete was concerned, this was a folk song. The way in which the audience joins in on the vocals here is also quite aesthetically delicious. In the second half of the show, Pete sings more traditional ballads, spirituals, Weaver songs, and Leadbelly tunes. His performance of Huey Leadbetter's Bourgeois Blues is especially prominent, not just because of what are really rock and roll licks on the 12-string acoustic guitar, but lyrically, the song is also very positively received. As the liner notes to the album explain, the students who recorded the show wanted to broadcast the performance the next day over the radio, which they did. Pete was amenable to this, however, only if he could receive the tapes afterwards. The students agreed, and a few weeks later the tapes were sent to Pete in the mail, and they ended up in Mo Ash's office in Manhattan, amongst thousands of other recordings. Mo Ash's approach in releasing live Seeger material would be to compile selections from different live shows, which is what the public got for many years. What's great about this release is that we can hear all these songs all together in succession.
Start over again, the higher key.
Seeger continued mostly doing these community concerts until after his acquittal in the spring of 1962, although by the beginning of the 60s he was beginning to play small venues and nightclubs again. One particular Folkways record that stands out from these settings is Live at the Village Gate with Memphis Slim and Willie Dixon from 1960. It's unclear how Seeger got booked with these two blues greats, if it was Harold Leventhal's idea or something else, but the combination is a total celebration of roots music before it was ever really known as such. There is, of course, debate as to when quote-unquote roots music was formally organized as a genre. Many people point to the band as being the originators of this in their first two albums in 1968 and 1969, but this is already probably too late. As Elijah Wald explains in his book, Dylan Goes Electric, about Seeger, Dylan, and the Newport Festival, it was, in Wald's view, in June 1965 when roots music was quote-unquote born, one with Dylan's collaboration with Mike Bloomfield, Al Cooper, and producer Tom Wilson at Columbia Studio A in putting together Like a Rolling Stone. Two, Wald says roots music was being established with not just the Newport Festival itself, but through other efforts, such as a concert that happened the day after the recording of Like a Rolling Stone, when the Newport promoters put on a concert at Carnegie Hall called The Evolution of Funk. This was a show set up by Dave Van Ronk and featured players like Sunhouse, Eric Von Schmidt, and Muddy Waters with his full electric band, headlined by Chuck Berry. But was the summer of 65 really the inception of roots music? At the very least, roots music was already deeply underway before then. Outside of collaborations going on between Dylan and his affiliates in the Village in the early 60s, Pete Seeger had been at this a while. He had played with Josh White, had been performing with Big Bill Brunzi in the 50s, and had been reworking Leadbelly songs for the banjo for years by this point. In regard to Live at the Village Gate, while there wasn't anything electric or plugged in that evening in Greenwich Village in 1960, Pete Seeger was playing the five-string banjo alongside a blues rhythm section, something that was, and still very much is, almost entirely unheard of. This album is tribute to all that is exciting and glorious about live folk and roots performance, and is a landmark concert from the standpoint of several genres. We can only assume how the songs for this show were chosen, but obviously, even though folk traditions are all cousins of one another, they had to pick tunes they could all play together. While he did a few Appalachian songs, Pete stuck to many 12-bar blues numbers and gospel spirituals, and while they don't play on every song, this allows Dixon and Slim to make some strong contributions on the bass and piano, respectively, with Dixon also backing Pete up on vocals on a variety of tunes. Some standout numbers from this concert are the spirituals I'm On My Way to Canaan Land, Oh Mary, Don't You Weep, Don't You Moan, and Don't Weep After Me.
I ask my sister, to come with me. I ask my sister to come with me. I ask my sister to come with me. Oh, I'm on my way. Great God, I'm on my way. Now we gotta get some harmony on this song.
If you listen to the full album, you'll hear Seeger, Slim, and Dixon fishing around on Oh Mary, Don't You Weep, Don't You Moan, probably not having rehearsed anything, looking for verses. But this looseness and improvisational aspect of the performance is, of course, the beauty of folk and roots music. Pete puts a lot of effort into getting the audience to sing here, as well, showing them the different harmony parts they can fit their voices into. The authenticity of the show is further preserved by virtue of the fact that we can hear the clinking of glasses and silverware in the background, and the light conversation of those not directly paying attention to the music. The banjo comes through very clearly, and we can distinctly hear Pete's style of strumming chords and his quote-unquote whamming method of using his index finger to hit the fourth and fifth strings of the banjo before brushing down on the third or fourth quarter notes. This is mixed with him taking his time between notes and playing the melodic and lead lines and doing breaks or bridges because he has the piano and bass behind him filling things in. Pete does attempt to make things a little more eclectic here than just this, however, by bringing in a couple of South African and Bahamian songs and topical numbers like Ernie Mars' song Quiz Show, making fun of the fixed television show scandals of the late 1950s. The record finishes up with a tasteful version of Leadbelly's Midnight Special.
A dozen big companies are giving away hundreds and thousands of dollars, they say. They ask you some questions and someone keeps score, and they slip you the answers a few days before. Oodle-dang-fol-dee-dido, oodle-dang-fol-dee-dum. Come along to the quiz show and join in the fun.
Dress she wore, umbrella on her shoulder, piece of paper in her hand. Goes a marching to the captain, says, I want my man to let the midnight special shine a light on me.
Now, that's just technically volume one of this concert. There is a second volume of Live at the Village Gate that Folkways released a couple years later, which includes a great banjo version of the gospel and civil rights song Keep Your Hand on the Plow, which ended up on many compilation albums in later years. This is a unique rendition because throughout the 60s, Pete would usually end up playing the song on the guitar when doing it live.
Noah the rainbow sign, no more water but fire next time. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on, hold on. Keep your hand on the plow, hold on. United Nations make a chain, every link is freedom's name. Keep your hand on.
Much of Volume 2 does not include songs that Dixon or Slim play on, and it does not sound as if they are backing Pete up on Keep Your Hand on the Plow either. There are, however, a couple of notable exceptions on this record, such as with the Field Holler / Prison song Another Man Done Gone, as well as Pete's version of the Jimmy Rogers tune TB Blues, and the blues song Every Evening When the Sun Goes Down, with these latter two incorporating some sweet banjo and piano licks, and you can really hear the percussion of Dixon slapping the upright bass in several places.
From the county far, from the county far, from the county farm, from the county farm. He killed another man. He killed another man. He killed another man. He killed another man.
when the sun go down. Memphis, you take it away.
In the liner notes for Volume 1 of this record, Pete amusingly writes that there are advantages to singing in a nightclub. He explains that now, that is, in 1960, it is possible to sing songs of people's real experience and get away with it, and people want to hear those songs now. He also says, amusingly, that the danger of playing in a nightclub is getting to like it too much. In his own words, quote, "There are disadvantages too. Most nightclubs cost an arm and a leg to get out of. Thus, many working people cannot afford to come. Furthermore, they are all too hot, smoky, and one still has to compete with noise from the kitchen. But all this is petty carping. I repeat, it is good practice for a singer to try singing in a saloon occasionally." Unquote. All in all, Live at the Village Gate is not just a fantastic display of Seeger's instrumental versatility and musicianship, but it is also an outstanding contribution to American roots music writ large. Now, while Seeger had worked with Mo Ash at Folkways Records for nearly 20 years now, and while Folkways would likely always remain his true home for making and releasing albums, in 1961, Pete Seeger was suddenly signed to Columbia Records. The man largely responsible for making this happen was, of course, John Hammond, who went to bat for Pete when Columbia's upper management needed convincing that it would be good to have Seeger on the label. Columbia President Goddard Lieberson and Vice President Richard Sallant fought Hammond on this initially, saying that Columbia didn't need Seeger. Sallant's complaint was that they shouldn't stick their neck out, considering how Seeger was not welcome on CBS television. Lieberson apparently conferred with Sallant privately, and Sallant wondered if Seeger would sell. Apparently, Hammond had convinced Lieberson that the answer was yes, so Seeger was signed. The record company still didn't completely trust Seeger, though, and, according to David Dunaway, Seeger didn't know about this whole conversation until 15 years later. Whether Pete's records quote-unquote sold or not was not important to him personally. Obviously, Columbia had the power to market and distribute in a way that Folkways could not, and so Pete's main desire was to get the music out there and have more people hear it. So, Pete was on Columbia, but what about Folkways? Well, an agreement was struck up that if Pete were to do a record or record a live show that was expected to do well commercially, Columbia would have first dibs on the material. And in exchange, Pete could continue to record other material for Folkways, and Mo Ash would be allowed to continue issuing older material of Pete's as he saw fit. The first record Seeger did for Columbia was the live album Story Songs in 1962. This concert was recorded at the Village Gate in Greenwich Village on Sunday, April 30th, 1961, and consisted of mostly ballads and mildly topical songs. There are classics here like Hobo's Lullaby, Woody Guthrie's Pretty Boy Floyd, and John Henry, but this record also includes other songs that don't appear in many other places, such as the Sons of the Pioneers tune Way Out There, about a hobo that gets thrown off of a freight train. Another often unknown topical composition is Washington Square, a very timely number referring to how the city of New York tried to ban singing in Washington Square Park on Sunday afternoons, which failed after about a month. Worth mentioning for sure is the amusing and funny Amy McPherson, written by John Lomax Jr., about the 1920s evangelical preacher whose story about being potentially kidnapped and having an affair down at Carmel by the Sea in California will probably never have the truth fully confirmed.
A lonely spot I know, where no man will go, where the shadows have all a room. I was riding free on the old SP, humming a solemn tune, when a man came along, made me hush my song, kicked me off the way out there. Loudly
the notes of the sparrow are sounding. Squawks of the pigeons are filling the air. Over the grass, a policeman comes bounding to silence the singing in Washington Square. Newbold Morris, sir, our park commissioner, says stop the music and that they will do. Let not a note be heard from either man or bird. Strike down the guitarists, oh Morrisable. Amy McPherson got back from her journey. She told a story to the district attorney. She said she'd been kidnapped on a lonely trail, and in spite of a lot of questions, she stuck to her tale. Well, the grand jury started an investigation, uncovered a lot of spicy information. Found out about a love nest down at Carmel by the sea, where the liquor is expensive and the loving is free.
The liner notes to Story Songs were written, oddly enough, by future Hollywood film director Peter Bogdanovich. Bogdanovich began his career as a film critic and somehow was recruited by Columbia to write the liner notes to Seeker's album, in retrospect, a somewhat unlikely pairing. In truth, Bogdanovich doesn't say much here. The back of the LP is a time-stamped description of the order of the songs, how Seeger introduces them, and what the setting and feel of the room is like. Bogdanovich does pay attention to how Seeger brings the audience in for singing, but awareness of the lyrical or musical depth or meaning of the songs appears largely lost here. What Bogdanovich does reveal, however, is that the whole concert is not on the LP. He mentions that Seeger played the Bells of Rhymney, for example, even though the spelling is absolutely incorrect, as well as the song When I First Came to This Land, among other tunes that Columbia clearly cut out from the final release. While you can find the songs on YouTube for the most part, it seems as if the record is not available through any of the major music distribution platforms, such as Apple Music or Spotify. It would be amazing to hear the whole show if Columbia were to decide to release everything at some point. Another noteworthy live record released on Columbia from this time is The Bitter and the Sweet, recorded at the Bitter End and released in 1962. Many tunes on the A side of this record would eventually end up on the compilation album Pete Seeger's Greatest Hits many decades later, but rightfully so. One such of these is the opening track, We Shall Overcome. Perhaps one of, if not the most famous song of the civil rights movement, the tune has its melodic origins in both European and black traditions, being possibly derived from Italian folk tunes, and some of its top line is similar to the old anti-slavery song, No More Auction Block. By the early 20th century, it had become I Will Overcome, being sung in southern black churches. The we got added when the song was used by striking tobacco workers in Charleston, South Carolina in 1945 and 46. Seeger learned the song in 1947 from Zilphia Horton at Highlander Folk School in Tennessee, who learned it from some of the Charleston tobacco workers who had come to visit there. Seeger soon changed the will to shall when he sang it, which has stuck ever since. In 1957, Highlander was having its 25th anniversary celebration and invited Seeger to perform, which is where he met Martin Luther King Jr. for the first time, who had been invited to come up from Montgomery to give a speech. Rosa Parks and Reverend Abernathy were also present on that day, September 2, 1957, when Seeger introduced the song to King and a bunch of others. Just as a note, the only other time Seeger would end up interacting with Martin Luther King was at a rally in 1967 at the UN building in New York City. At no other point did Seeger or King directly work together. But the song had a rapid cultural and geographical diffusion and became known as a unifying force that brought whites and blacks together, and as Bernice Regan of the Freedom Singers once stated, singing We was a statement of affirmation by black people, specifically of the need for the fight against injustice to be cross-racial. The other change that Seeger made to the song was giving it more rhythm. Originally, it was a very loose gospel song, yet in using the 12-string guitar, Pete rocked it up a bit with 12/8 time, which is how we hear it in this performance.
Someday, deep in my heart,
Some other iconic songs on this album include Pete's lovely 12-string guitar instrumental, Living in the Country, a cover of Leadbelly's Mr. Tom Hughes Town about the boss of Shreveport, Louisiana's red light district, and the famous Turn, Turn, Turn.
Follow me down to Mr. Tom Hughes' town.
A time to gain, a time to lose, a time to rend, a time to sow, a time of love, a time of hate, a time of peace. I swear it's not too late to everything. Turn, 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 there is a season. Turn, 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 and a time to every purpose.
As many of us know, the lyrics to Turn, Turn, Turn were taken from the book of Ecclesiastes in the Bible, a favorite set of verses Pete had arranged to a 1-4-5 chord progression, adding the words about peace, I swear it's not too late. Judy Collins ended up doing a version on her third album the following year, and the rest of the world would hear the song when the Byrds released their version in late 1965. Another great tune from the B-side of the record is Pete's version of California songwriter Malvina Reynolds' song, Andorra, about the tiny country in the Pyrenees Mountains in the northeastern Iberian Peninsula. The chorus line, quote, "They spent $4.90 on armaments in their defense," unquote, refers to the fact that the country of 5,000 had allocated less than $5 for their entire defense budget, the purpose of which was to pay for blank cartridges to be set off on ceremonial occasions. A nod by Malvina Reynolds to a place that did not have endless expenditures on defense.
In the mountains of the Pyrenees, there's an independent state. Its population, 5,000 souls, and I think they're simply great. 170 square miles big, and it's mighty plain to see. They spent less than $5 on armaments, and this I got to see. I wanna go to Andorra, Andorra, Andorra. I wanna go to Andorra, it's a land that I adore. $4.90 on armaments and their defense. Did you ever hear such confidence? Andorra,
hip-a-ra. On the whole, while Pete of course does play banjo in this performance, the majority of Seeger's playing utilizes the 12-string guitar. Like Story Songs, Columbia Records and or its corporate conglomerates have not made this album electronically available on digital media platforms either, which is sad. You can find a couple vinyl rips on YouTube, or, better yet, get yourself a copy of the LP itself, as it seems that this one circulates pretty well. These shows became popular records for Seeger, and during this period of the early 60s, Columbia was relatively successful in producing Seeger albums that sold well. One particular live performance that was nominated for the Grammy category of Best Children's Folk Album was Children's Concert at Town Hall. This show was recorded at New York City's Town Hall, April 28, 1962, and was produced by Harold Leventhal, being released by Columbia in 1963. We can hear children being fidgety and chatting throughout this concert, as to be expected, but Seeker does an impeccable job in playing the songs that are needed in the moment to keep the kids' attention, especially by starting the show with his take on the Appalachian tune, Little Birdie.
What makes you fly so high? It's because I'm a true little bird, and I do not fear to die.
The rest of the album sort of functions as a musical geography lesson, where Pete does a so-called trip around the world, sharing songs from different countries. He does this with the English song Henry My Son, which the kids get a kick out of, and Get Along Little Doggies, about cattle ranching in the Western Plains. Seeger also utilizes a geographical theme to show children how technology has changed over time, such as with Erie Canal about the development of New York State, working on a railroad to talk about labor and connecting people between the eastern and western parts of the country, and the famous Abiyoyo in talking about South Africa. Where Pete really has everyone in the palm of his hand, though, is with the story song The Foolish Frog, a story he had long before learned from his father Charles. The Foolish Frog, while being partly a song, is a moral tale about a farmer who writes a song about a frog, and the whole town shows up at the corner store to sing it, except for the frog, who is not invited.
So all there is left of the frog is the song. We might as well sing her once again. Do you know it? Away down south in the yaggity yank, a bullfrog jumped from bank to bank just because he'd nothing better for to do. He stubbed his toe and fell in the water, stubbed his toe, fell in the water. You could hear him holler for a mile and a quarter just because he'd nothing better for to do. Can you whistle?
The author of the liner notes on the LP cover is not stated, but Seeger is relegated to being the, quote, Pied Piper of American folk music, unquote, and a folk music, quote, conveyor belt, unquote. More titles we can only imagine made Pete uncomfortable. The notes explain that Seeger has been singing to children for years, and that a children's concert is important because it is the ideal way for folk music to be preserved. If you want to listen to the whole record of Children's Concert, I'd recommend finding it electronically for the reason that the LP is disappointingly missing many tracks, including The Foolish Frog, Shenandoah, Skip to My Lou, I've Been Working on the Railroad, Ilka's Bedouin Tune from Israel, The Fisherman Song from Japan, Let Everyone Clap Hands, Frère Jacques, and Didn't Old John Cross the Water, a work song that Seeger would sing a cappella while splitting a log on stage with an axe that he brought along. Additionally, some dialogue is removed from song introductions, such as when Seeger tells the kids about Leadbelly when introducing the Grey Goose. In the full version, he says, quote, "It's sort of a lesson for you and me, you see. Whatever they try and do to you, you just don't let them do it. You keep on going," unquote. On the LP, the phrase, "Whatever they do to you, you just don't let them do it," is sadly censored out. We don't know whether it was Columbia or Leventhal that made this decision, if it was time, or if others saw what Pete was saying as controversial for parents, but all I can say is that when I heard that line on the cassette release in the early 90s, it always stuck with me. I'm really glad I had the opportunity to hear that line uncut. If there are parents listening to the podcast here, or if there's anyone who knows folks with young children, there may not be a better record for introducing kids to folk music. If you know of anyone whose children might benefit from some initial exposure, which of course is really anyone, I'd highly recommend this album. In summary, I think that what is great about Children's Concert is not just how captivating Pete is with the kids in attendance, but how many of them seem to already know so many of the songs. This is quite pronounced on the number Seeger uses to close the show.
This is
As we can interpret from his being signed to Columbia Records, and the size and popularity of these live shows, Seeger's audiences began growing in number far beyond what they were in the 50s. Now, instead of making $25 a show, he was making thousands. At one point, Pete even confronted Harold Leventhal about a fee he had received, and being uncomfortable with how much he was making, explained to Harold that as his manager, he had to charge much less. But Pete's new popularity was mirrored by the popularity of other musicians in similar genres and styles. By the early 60s, folk music had emerged from the shadows and had become pop music. The Weavers and their music had been forced into obscurity 10 years before, and with Elvis in the military, Chuck Berry in jail, and Jerry Lee Lewis's reputation publicly stained, rock and roll was taking a hiatus. The Kingston Trio was on the rise, with their pop brand of folk music, largely in part due to banjo player Dave Gard learning to play from Pete's How to Play the Five-String Banjo booklet. While they had many, many hits, most people will probably know the song Tom Dooley, which made its way into the mainstream from Smoky Mountain's banjo player Frank Prophet, and MTA, the political campaign song about the raising of fares in the rapid transit network of Boston, written by previous members of the Almanac Singers, Sis Cunningham and Bess Lomax.
I met her on the mountain. There I took her life. Met her on the mountain. Stabbed her with my knife. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Hang down your head and cry. Hang down your head, Tom Dooley. Poor boy, you're bound to die.
No, he never returned, and his fate is still unlearned.
He may
ride forever beneath the streets of Boston. He's the man who never returned.
Pick it, Dave.
Now, you citizens of Boston, don't you think it's a scandal how the people have to pay?
Of the other major groups, Peter, Paul, and Mary were also at the forefront of the scene, and not just with songs like Peter Yarrow's Puff the Magic Dragon, but also with their cover of Seeger and Lee Hayes's If I Had a Hammer.
Well, I got a hammer, and I got a bell, and I got a song to sing,
sing
over this land. It's a hammer of justice, it's a bell of freedom. Song about love between the brothers and the sisters all over this land. It's a hammer of justice. It's a bell of freedom.
But despite the new folk boom, Seeger's popularity was not welcomed by all, however. He was canceled twice in 1 week in April 1962 and had a contract canceled when he was about to be taped for a Pittsburgh television station. At Queens College, Seeger was canceled from playing, with the president saying Seeger had never been scheduled. There were continued limitations with the blacklist, but things seemed slightly more possible than before. Now that Seeger no longer had to operate in his entirety in the underground, being able to go out and make these new records and do these live shows gave Pete some new ideas. By 1962, Seeger was attempting to design a television show for the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. Pete wanted to find a way to use the post-war mass media in such a way that it benefited people and folk music to better show others how rich in folk music and culture the country really was. Seeger thought this was now at least a possible reality because, one, his legal battles were over, and two, people were paying more attention to folk music in general. Long story short, ultimately, the CBC did not accept Seeger's proposal. One big potential breakthrough came, though, when Harold Leventhal received an offer for Pete to perform on a television program called Dinner with the President. This one-hour program stated it was to recognize folk and dance history and how it illustrated social struggle in the American experience. Writing credits for this program list the Columbia University professor and famed writer Mark Van Doren and Judy Collins, Josh White, Odetta, and Tommy Makem and the Clancy Brothers were slated to perform. President Kennedy, Pete Seeger's former Harvard classmate, was to speak and receive the Democratic Legacy Award from the show's sponsor, the Anti-Defamation League of the B'nai B'rith, the Jewish and pro-Israel advocacy organization. But not long before the show was to be taped, the ADL called Leventhal's office and informed Harold that they had made a mistake in hiring Seeger. Did Leventhal not know that there was a blacklist and that Seeger could not perform on network television? The ADL arrogantly requested Joan Baez as a replacement, to which Harold angrily refused. Was it the songs that worried CBS? More likely than not, it was Seeger's reputation. And even if they didn't personally have any feelings about lyrical material, as a network, they weren't going to stick their necks out. With the CBS appearance fading into the sunset, Seeger suddenly got a request to perform on a new ABC television show called Hootenanny. ABC was organizing a show that was to be taped at multiple colleges and universities around the country, and was to feature new up-and-coming acts presenting this new thing called folk music to younger audiences. Of course, folk music wasn't anything new, and another red flag was the use of the name. As we can recall, this was a word Seeger and Woody Guthrie had picked up singing for labor unions in Seattle, and it was now being appropriated for something commercial, and its significance was being lost. Seeger later lamented not copywriting this word so as to better protect its usage, not just because of this show, but also because a variety of publications and magazines arose out of nowhere that jumped on the Hootenanny bandwagon because suddenly the word could sell.
This is Jack Linkletter. If you like folk music, you'll love Hootenanny. The songs come from all over the world. They speak of work, play, and of traveling. Folk songs also speak of love.
When I was a young girl, had never been kissed, I got to thinking over just what I had missed.
Then there are songs of joy and hope. Join the well-known folk singers who get together every week for a Hootenanny on ABC TV.
Despite its quirky and questionable prospectus, Seeger was interested in performing. He was not invited to play on the first few shows, but was assured by Fred Weintraub, the show's chief advisor, that they would get him on soon. But by February 1963, Seeger still had not received a contract. Then in March, a rumor started circulating that made its way back to Harold Leventhal's office that stated that no, Seeger wouldn't actually end up appearing after all because of, quote, pressure from advertising agencies, sponsors, and stations, unquote. Journalist Nat Hentoff of the Village Voice researched the predicament and in a March 14th article commented that it was completely hypocritical to exclude Seeger from something like this and charged performers to boycott the show. But what did Hootenanny actually sound like? For the most part, much of the folk music, or so-called folk music, presented on Hootenanny was remarkably fake. As we have heard, there were some strong up-and-coming acts, but many acts lacked sophistication and true appreciation for the music. Additionally, audiences, depending upon the song and the artist, were not always invited to sing along, and acts sort of just played in a consumption-oriented manner. This, of course, was the antithesis of what Seeger's vision would have been for such a program anyway. In terms of how the boycott played out, the Clancy Brothers appeared, but Tommy Makem did not. Johnny Cash, Bob Gibson, and Mother Maybelle Carter appeared, but Joan Baez, Ramblin' Jack Elliott, and Peter Paul and Mary did not. Dave Van Ronk proudly refused to play, as did the Weavers and the Kingston Trio, but Theodore Bakel performed. Judy Collins was thinking of bailing, but Seeger encouraged her and others to do the show, and she did end up performing, as Seeger saw there were opportunities available for the dissemination of folk music, and, on the overall, he felt as if this was something younger musicians should be taking advantage of. Despite this exposure, Judy Collins was quite disgusted when verses from her version of John Riley were cut when the show finally aired.
Now some come to dance, some come to play, Some merely come to pass time away. Some come to laugh, their voices do ring. But as for me, well, I come for to sing. Now some folks enjoy me and others do not. Some loudly proclaim about what I ain't got. But I don't mind, it don't mean a thing. I'll keep on coming, I come for to sing.
Eventually, a boycott committee was formed to organize against the blacklisting of Seeger here, led in part by Barbara Dane, Mary Travers, and Bob Dylan. And eventually a protest was held outside ABC Studios in Manhattan, with 50 or so people picketing ABC, with Georgia banjo player Hetty West improvising verses protesting this continued blacklist of Seeger from television. TV critic Jack Gould had written in the New York Times in April about Seeger that, quote, "Since he is at complete liberty to appear on stages and can be heard at home on recordings, why should TV prolong its blacklist? Mr. Seeger's credential for TV is his art, which is in order." Unquote. The line from ABC was the old one, too. They wanted Seeger, but the sponsors, Procter and Gamble, did not. The sponsors' line was that they wanted Seeger, but that the public didn't want him. In May, the executive producer of the show held a press conference and stated that Hootenanny just couldn't hire everyone, and that after listening to Seeger's records, ABC had determined that, quote, "Pete Seeger just can't hold an audience," unquote. After it sank in for certain that Hootenanny had been gaslighting him and that Pete wouldn't be on the show after all, he revealed his emotions and thoughts in an article for Sing Out magazine in the April-May 1963 issue, about network TV's ignorance. Seeger stated that there were many, many great musicians across the country who could bring real, authentic music to mass audiences, like Doc Watson, Horton Baker, Bessie Jones, and the Sea Island Singers. In Seeger's words, quote, "When will TV producers learn that some of the greatest music in our country is made by unlettered farmers, miners, housewives, people with generations of folk traditions in their veins? The great thing about the old Hootenannies was their ability to put together on one stage the old-timer and the new-timer, the city-billy and the hillbilly, the professional and the amateur. But the TV networks have not learned this lesson," unquote. Seeger was also interviewed by Ralph Gleason of the San Francisco Chronicle and said, quote, "I'm outraged. I actually get hot and flushed just thinking about it. We have all this richness and variety in our country, but a bunch of schmoes out to sell soap keep the whole country seeing the same dreary things night after night," unquote. Whether ABC knew or cared that they were effectively saying that Seeger wasn't up to their artistic standards essentially indicated the commercial and politically complacent prerogatives of the industry. Network television still wouldn't have Seeger for nearly another 5 years. As Dave Van Ronk remembered the incident, quote, "Pete always felt that music was the important thing. The man is nothing. The work is everything. And he thought that a lot of performers who deserved a national hearing were depriving themselves of an opportunity. His basic attitude was, for God's sake, boys, leave me behind. Just leave me one bullet. Of course, we paid absolutely no attention to him. Our position was, sorry, Pete, old man, but you are a symbol." And in any case, Hootenanny was so laughably awful that it barely lasted a season, unquote. In terms of how he really felt deep down, Seeger was perhaps more bitter than he let on in the press. But Pete was done with all this capitalistic childishness, and he knew that this was not a hill he could win right now. Pete and Toshi had been discussing leaving the country for over a year by this point, and they wanted to travel and do this before their three kids got much older. Just before leaving, ABC offered Seeger a spot after all, if he would sign a loyalty oath. Seeger wrote ABC a letter in response, quote, "Dear ABC, I just finished a 7-year court battle to prove the principle that such oaths are unconstitutional, and I was acquitted and vindicated," unquote. Pete also made himself a note that said, "Release after departure."
I looked down the track just as far as I could see.
I look down the track, just as far as I could see, a little bitty hand was waving after me. A city of tears,
joining us, everyone, for this episode. This was a fun one to do because I really just enjoy listening to the records again and breaking them down, and I can't go through every single song for many of these because there's just too much material, but picking and choosing which songs to talk about and which ones to lyrically or musically deconstruct and present through the show is a lot of fun, and I had a good time doing it. It's disappointing that some of these records are so hard to find and they're so hard to get. These Columbia records, which were significant for Seeger, I mean, not to underwrite folkways in any way, but this was a turning point in certain respects. And it's sad that Story Songs and The Bitter and the Sweet are not anywhere near as accessible as they should be. And if you don't do records, if you don't do LPs, then it's hard to... You can listen on YouTube to these records in full. They've been ripped. People have done this, but it's hard to get access to them otherwise. It's possible. You got to do a little bit more work, but it's too bad it's not immediately as available to people. Maybe doing the work, though, is important, and that's what this is all about, too. That shows us what music means to us. I encourage you to listen to all that stuff. It's really great. I wanted to couple that with the stuff about Hoot Nanny, because it's all sort of going on just about the same time, 61, 62, 63. And Seeger still is fighting the blacklist and continues to do so, not so much legally, but and still in terms of how folk music is interpreted and understood, and his attempts to further and further try and get authenticity across, and the difficulties he faces in doing so, and his contemporaries face in doing so. In this case, I think that his idealism, which really is the foundation of Pete Seeger, maybe got away from him a little bit and took him for a ride, and that ended up hurting him, I think, in certain ways. It's not like he bit off more than he could chew. It was just that the world still was not ready to accept Pete Seeger. And so that the outcome was something sort of phony, like Hootenanny. Many people learned about folk music through Hootenanny, but like Seeger says, it's not the real thing, and there are so many artists that were marginalized and made more obscure by not giving them the exposure that this show could have given them, so that's disappointing. In our next episode, we turn to an interview in August. We'll have, and I did an interview with David Dunaway, Pete Seeger's biographer, in May, and that will be presented as our next episode, and that should be pretty exciting. So please watch for that. I'm sure many of you will enjoy listening to that. So see you all next time.